For many of us, seeing the beauty in other people, being kind and compassionate towards other people, that comes pretty easily. But what's really hard is seeing the beauty in ourselves and being kind and compassionate consistently towards ourselves, especially when difficult things happen. Perhaps someone's critical of us, or we make a mistake. We beat up on ourselves. You could call it the inner critic, or that voice in the head that says mean things. Or you could call it self-hatred. What can we do in these circumstances to interrupt this cycle and learn to befriend ourselves consistently? Sounds True has created the Self-Acceptance Project to investigate this question. We've invited the participation of spiritual teachers, psychologists, neuroscientists, visionary writers, all to look at how can we learn to be kind and compassionate towards ourselves on a consistent basis. Thank you for joining us and welcome. Today I speak with Tara Brach, a clinical psychologist and leading teacher of Buddhist meditation, emotional healing, and spiritual awakening. She's the founder and senior teacher of the Insight Meditation Community of Washington, D.C. Tara has done numerous projects with Sounds True, including the audio programs Radical Self-Acceptance and Meditations for Emotional Healing. My name's Tammy Simon, and I'm your host for this series, and in today's episode, I'm speaking with Tara Brach. Tara, welcome.
Ah, lovely to be here, Tammy.
I'm so happy that you're able to participate in this Self-Acceptance Project series of conversations, because really it wouldn't feel complete to me without you. And I say that because in many ways, you were one of the first people to bring this topic of self-acceptance to the Sounds True audience in a strong and clear way. It was almost a decade ago that we worked together to create an audio series called Radical Self-Acceptance. And I wanted to start our conversation by turning back the clock a little bit and understanding what was happening inside of you and in your teaching work that you wanted to focus on this topic of radical self-acceptance.
Well, you know, it was not even just starting at that time. For probably the decade, two decades before, it just had become so clear to me that my deepest suffering, kind of the core of it, was a sense of not enough. And when it was really bad, real self-aversion. And I saw it in students and clients, and I think of it as probably the most pervasive suffering in our society. And so in my work with myself, you know, it came to a head, I remember, in college when a friend of mine said, you know, I'm learning to be my own best friend. And I realized, oh my God, I'm the furthest from that. And then over time, through different experiences, realized I really just didn't trust myself. So I decided to write the book Radical Acceptance and do the CDs with Sounds True with you, because it felt like if we can't recognize what I call the trance of unworthiness, how much our being is trapped in a sense of falling short, and usually it's on every front in some way. There's some sort of a background that's monitoring, well, how am I doing now? And usually finding there's a gap between our standard for who we should be and our moment-to-moment experience. And that gap makes us feel always in some way like we're not okay. So that's some of the background. I'll just say more recently, a woman who's a palliative caregiver worked with thousands of people, being with them as they're dying, said that the number one deepest regret of the dying are that they didn't live true to themselves, that they lived according to the expectations of others, according to the shoulds, but not true to their own being. And that when we sense under that, there was not enough trust of who they were to be listen and really live aligned with heart and spirit. And I just think that speaks worlds, Tammy, that we can go through our life so turned on ourselves and so mistrusting that at the end there's this sense of, I didn't really live this life really true to who I am.
Hmm. Now, you've said a couple things here that I want to tease out. One is you introduced this phrase, the trance of unworthiness. Can you talk a little bit about how you see it as a trance?
You know, if I did a hand raise with a large group of people and said, you know, how many of you judge yourself too much? Probably most hands would go up. But I think what we don't realize is how much that sense of something's wrong with me pervades our day, and it actually contracts everything, so that in our relating with other people, we don't realize how much what we're doing in any given moment is to have another person perceive us a certain way, approve of us, love us. It's very hard to be really intimate when we're in some deep way feeling flawed or deficient. It's hard to be spontaneous or creative at work or take risks in our life, or even just relax in the moment if we think that we're falling short. So it's a trance that really imprisons our moments in a way that we're not aware of.
Well, and of course, staying with that image, that metaphor of being in a trance, what do you think wakes people up from a trance like that?
What I've seen is it's the suffering of it, and the suffering comes out in a lot of different ways. It may be that in a relationship, a person realizes, I can never feel like I can really get close to someone. And then when they look closely, they realize I figure no matter if somebody got to know me, they'd reject me. And then they get, wow, all my life I've been feeling like I'll be rejected if somebody really sees who I am. And that pain is kind of a wake up to really explore, well, how do we begin to stop the war against ourselves? So the wake up's usually some form of suffering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now the other theme that you mentioned in just responding to this first question about your dedication, if you will, to this whole area of radical self-acceptance, radical acceptance, was trusting ourselves. And I know so often when I listen to people, what I hear them asking me, if they're asking me a question or looking for advice, is that they want to be given permission to trust themselves. You know, you can trust yourself. You can trust what you're feeling here. You can trust your inspiration. And I'm curious to know what you think are the keys to helping people develop that sense of self-trust. You can trust yourself.
Well, I'll share a story from just this week where a woman came up to me after a class and said, you know, I am really at war with myself because of the way I'm treating my 5-year-old daughter, and I'm bursting out in anger all the time, and I'm criticizing her, and I don't deserve to accept myself. I mean, how can I trust myself if I'm doing this? And so what we started exploring was that she couldn't trust that she wouldn't act in ways that were harmful, because we do act in ways that are harmful. So that's not what we can develop trust around. But then when I said, do you love your daughter? And then tears came up, and she just said, of course, I wouldn't be so upset about this if I didn't love my daughter. And I said, spend some time just reflecting on loving her, what you love about her, and just feel that loving awareness in you. And just get to know that as really the place you can trust. And that really resonated for her, Tammy, because, you know, if we want to try to trust or accept our ego self, it's not going to work. Because the ego self is unreliable, out of control, will cause trouble, is striving, is afraid. So building a true sense of trust, it comes from contacting the deeper parts of our being. And that takes some paying attention. For her, a deeper part of her being was an unquestionable love for her daughter, even if she acted in a way she didn't like. So that's just an example of what allows us to start trusting ourselves.
So really, to underscore what you're saying, it's contacting that sense of us that we know is trustworthy.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, now I want to circle back for a moment, because people who are watching and listening to this self-acceptance series, many people have now listened to, you know, over a dozen different teachers and presenters and neuroscientists talk about what is self-acceptance and how can we do it. And I'm imagining someone who says, you know, when I hear Tara saying, I know that there's some sense of me, I feel unworthy of being fully loved by my partner, for example, and the suffering that's in that. I can imagine people really identifying with that and saying, yeah, that's me, I get it. The reason I'm listening to this series and continuing to is because I sense the suffering that I'm in, that there's some aspect of this sense of unworthiness, trance of unworthiness, that I'm really suffering from. So I would love it, Tara, if you could address that person directly. Where do you think they go from there once they've identified this suffering?
Very often we cannot jump to, okay, I'm going to go look for the beautiful, good, loving parts of myself. Very often the pathway to acceptance comes with being able to start pausing when we feel we're caught in something's wrong with me, I'm unworthy. So let's say I'm unworthy of my partner's love because I'm a selfish person, or I'm unworthy because I'm, you know, not a fun or spontaneous person, or I'm unworthy, whatever the reason. We start to pause there. And by the way, I feel like pausing, the training and learning to pause when we're caught in those moments is critical. Because it's like Frankl says, between the stimulus and the response, there is a space. And in that space is our power and our freedom. So the first step is pause. When you get caught in that trance of unworthiness, you feel the suffering, pause. And then the second step is to deepen attention, to begin to notice, well, underneath all these thoughts, what's going on in my body, my heart right now, and to begin to actually bring a presence to just how painful it is. I sometimes call it the sense of ouch, and you might even sense how long it's been going on, that, wow, I've been feeling not enough for as long as I can remember. So to start beginning to bring an attention to that, and I'm putting my hand on my heart right now, because if we can begin to bring even an intention to be kind towards that place that's suffering. And when I say intention, we can't manufacture feeling kind, but just a sense of, okay, I want to be able to be gentle with this place that feels so bad. There's a shift that starts happening. And the shift is that we actually move from the unworthy self to that kind of compassionate presence that is witnessing and with the unworthy self. That shift is the movement towards freedom, Tammy. It's that moment where we have become present and offered a kindness, or the intention of kindness, where there's a real transformation. So that's kind of a step-by-step, without getting into content too much, of how a kind of meditative presence with some intention towards kindness can begin to shift things.
Mm-hmm. Tara, I want to talk more about the ouch moment, because you mentioned staying with the ouch, and I think for a lot of people that's very difficult. I mean, obviously it's painful. I don't want to stay with that. I mean, I can stay with it for 30 seconds or a minute, but on and on and on. I mean, that asks a lot.
That's where the kindness comes in. I often teach people to put their hands on their hearts, and the reason I do is because just trying to stay with a painful experience can be grueling and actually wear down our spirit, wear down our energy, everything. But if we in some way have a gesture towards ourselves that I'm being with this as a way of comforting, as a way of healing, there's a real power to that. And sometimes what I'll do is, if being with ourselves in that way is too much, I'll invite a person to imagine someone who is truly wise and accepting and compassionate to help them. And I found that's an incredibly valuable bridge to bringing this healing presence to ourselves. So, for instance, for myself, if I'm feeling caught in one of the ways I go into a trance of unworthiness, Tammy, is that over the last decade I've had some bouts of sickness that have been really humbling, because not only do I feel sick, but then I find that I become irritable and self-centered, and then I start not liking myself for being a bad sick person, mm-hmm. that I'm not being spiritual in how I'm being sick. So it's the Buddha called it the second arrow. The first arrow is that I feel sick. The second arrow is that sense of unworthiness for being a bad sick person. And what I found is that sometimes I'll pause then, and I'll begin to start feeling that sense of failing, of not being a good or together person. And I'll put my hand on my heart, and I'll just imagine that, for me, it's kind of the divine or sacred feminine. I'll imagine that there's some very understanding, loving, kind energy around me that's pouring through my hand. So in some way, I'm offering kindness to the bad sick person, but I'm calling on something larger than myself to do it. And gradually what I find is I'm no longer calling on something larger, because I have kind of relaxed open, and that's part of what I am, that kind attention. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a stepping stone, but it's a very powerful one.
Mm-hmm. In the beginning of our conversation, to circle back for a moment, you said that this feeling of our own unworthiness, in your view, could be considered one of the most pervasive forms of suffering in our time. And I wonder, do you think there's something about our contemporary context in which this is somehow, we're just discovering this sense of unworthiness that's always been there, or there's something about contemporary society where we're under more pressure that's making this worse, or how do you understand it?
I think it's a combo. I feel like that we all are rigged. It's part of being incarnated, to rig, to feel separate and to feel a sense, a kind of a fear that something's wrong or something's going to go wrong. So it's part of our survival equipment to, it's described as a kind of a negative bias where we fixate our mind on what's wrong or what can go wrong. And it's a very quick step to, not only is something wrong or bad, but I'm the one that's wrong or bad. And that's just part of our self-reflexive awareness, that we take it personally. We get identified with the badness. So I think that part's pervasive, that there's a sense of deficiency that comes with the evolving human ego. And it leads to fight flight, where we, you know, we fight against ourselves. We look for the cause of what's really wrong about me, and we fixate on it and we fight against it. So that all, I would say, is part of our wiring. I think there, in our contemporary culture, especially in the West, there are very few natural ways of belonging that help to reassure us of what you might call our basic goodness, our feeling connected and a part of something larger. And that exacerbates that sense of, I'm afraid, I'm wrong, I'm bad, I'm not okay, I'm deficient. We have a culture that's fear-based, that grasps on, that overconsumes, that's competitive. So there's always a standard we're supposed to be reaching towards. We're not invited towards contentment. That would stop the economy in its tracks. We're not invited to relax and say, this moment's enough. That would stop the economy in its tracks. So we're in a culture that's very revved and very grasping, and it really feeds this sense of, I should be more, I should be better. So again, I think it's a combo. And just as we might think of the tendency to fixate on wrong and bad as fight flight, we do have built into us also the capacity for tend and befriend. So it's there. It's just not that well cultivated in this fear-based kind of a culture. And I actually think of it as, this is the evolution of our consciousness, that in the same way we get caught in the trance of unworthiness, we have these capacities to tend and befriend, and they just take training. So when I teach about waking up from the trance, it's like once we get that we're suffering because we're at war with ourselves, there can be a very deep, sincere commitment to embracing our own being and embracing life everywhere. But it takes a kind of deliberate training of the mind to shift us from fixating on what's wrong to attending and befriending.
What do you see are some of the cultural innovations, if you will, whether it's at the level of family or community or even larger, that would help support this sense of belonging that you're pointing to that many of us don't feel?
Conscious community. I think that wherever we see the intention and the effort to be with each other in a way where we start taking the chance to share what's vulnerable, wherever we take the opportunity to mirror back with each other our goodness and our appreciation, where we learn to take the inevitable conflicts and turn them into an opportunity to deepen understanding. So again, just like meditation is working with attending and befriending in an inner way, when we bring those same skills with each other, so we listen deeply, so we bring a presence to our communication with each other, there's a sense of belonging to each other. There's a sense of, you know, opening to be part of what's around us that actually wakes up in neuroanatomy, wakes up the compassion networks when we're with each other in that way, and we can hold our lives in a different way.
Can you unpack that a little bit when you say it wakes up this neuroanatomy of compassion when we're with each other in that way?
Yeah.
What's happening there?
Sure. When we're in fear, we're in fight flight, and in a way, it disconnects us with the frontal cortex and the parts of the brain that are actually lit up when we're experiencing compassion. So when we're afraid, we're cut off from the very parts of ourselves that actually allow us to be more happy and free. So as we spend time with each other and discover the love and connectedness is there, the fear is reduced, and it actually makes us more capable of empathy. It makes us more capable of forgiving. It makes us more capable of embracing ourselves and each other. Mm-hmm. It just takes practice being with each other with that intention to be more conscious.
Mm-hmm. So here, Tara, you're someone who has been deep working in this field of self-acceptance for probably, you could say, 3 decades now, it sounds like, as you were talking about your inspiration for writing the book and making the audio programs on this topic. And I'm curious, if you were to trace the arc of working with self-acceptance in your own life, how you would show us that arc. I mean, where has it taken you now? Obviously, the question I think for people comes up, do you still go into bouts of feeling unworthiness? Does the trance still catch you?
Yes, it does. I still find that sometimes I'll be in a bad mood, and if I start scraping beneath the surface, I'll find that, oh, I'm down on myself. You know, I'm not coming through in the way I want to and being with my aging mother. I'm falling short as a friend. I wasn't really present the way I'd like to be in that talk. You know, I find that there's that's going on. And when it's really deep, you know, when I really feel like I've hurt somebody, it's very sticky. The difference between now and then meaning whatever, 15 years ago, kind of the gradual shift, is that there's less lag time. I more quickly recognize, oh, okay, I'm caught in the beliefs and feelings that have to do with an unworthy self. So A, there's less lag time. And I don't believe it as much. It's like the feelings are there and the thoughts are there, but the sense of who I am beyond the self that I'm judging are much more alive and accessible. That there is a beingness here, a loving heart, an awareness that isn't so identified with the unworthy self. But I still have to go from that feeling and thoughts of unworthiness, I still have to find my way back. And one of the ways I find my way back, and I teach about this a lot these days, is with this metaphor of a dog with its, you know, if you're in the woods and you see a dog behind by a tree and you go over to pet it and all of a sudden it springs at you and its fangs are bared and it's, you know, freaks you out. And all of a sudden you go from wanting to pet it to really being angry. But then you notice that under the leaves, its leg is caught in a trap. And then you go from being angry to, oh, you poor thing. If I can pause and get that in some way my leg's in a trap, in some way I've been behaving because I've been nervous about something or hurt by something or whatever it is, if I can get that the thing I'm judging is coming from some pain, then I soften. And then that process I described before of being present with just the feelings and offering some kindness loosens the grip so I can arrive more fully in that sense of who I am that's not trapped in that trance.
That's helpful. And I do want to offer our listeners this tool that you've become well known for at this point, the RAIN tool. And I wonder if you can introduce that in the context, actually, it seems to fit with what we've been talking about. In terms of this original R in RAIN, which, as you teach, stands for recognition, but then the rest of the process.
Yeah, RAIN is, I find that when we get stuck in trance, some part of us might know that we need to get present and we need to be kind and so on, but it's the hardest thing in the world to remember because those are the moments that we're most inclined to be reactive and just stir up things more. So the acronym RAIN is kind of this easy-to-remember handle that when we get caught in the trance of unworthiness, we can say, okay, just pause. And then the R is recognize what's going on. Okay, all the thoughts and feelings of unworthiness right here. And the A of RAIN is allow, which means we just allow it to be there. We don't try to get away from what's going on. It's kind of we deepen the pause. We just let it all be there so that we can move to the I of RAIN, which is we just begin to investigate a bit. It's kind of, I think of it as investigate with an intimate attention or investigate with kindness because we just bring a gentle yet interested attention to what's going on. And this is where we start loosening the grip to free us from the trance. And so, for example, I described before how when I get sick, I can then start turning on myself as the sick person. When I'd start investigating, I'd start, you know, sensing, well, under all the ideas of, oh, I should be less irritable and so on, was this sinking feeling, because you have to get under the thoughts, under the storyline. And it was when I'd start investigating and sensing this sinking feeling and this very core belief that, wow, if I am this bad at being sick, I'll never wake up and be free the way I want to be, you know. I'll never be enlightened. That sense of I'm not going to get there and the fear of being caught, and then I'd feel the fear, feel it in the body. That's the investigating. Investigating is connecting with what's going on in the body, but with kindness. So that's where I put my hand on my heart and sense my own kindness or the kindness from the loving awareness in the universe pouring into me. That's the eye of RAIN. Investigate with kindness. The N of RAIN means not identified. And it sounds like a dry term, but it's actually liberation. It's because when you're not identified, or when I'm not identified with that unworthy self, I'm free to inhabit my wholeness. I'm free to inhabit the loving awareness that's really here but been clouded over. So RAIN is a process of detangling the trance, and it really comes down to a mindful awareness with kindness.
Now, Tara, just one final question. We're calling this series the Self Acceptance Project. And here, as a Buddhist meditation teacher, talking about something like non-identification, you know, part of the classical Buddhist teachings have to do with, you know, recognizing that we're not this solid self. We're not the solid self people might think we are, we might think we are. How do you understand this paradox, if you will, that we have to learn to be kind and accept the self, and yet there's this big question about, is there even, quote unquote, a self there? How do you understand that?
I make a translation and think of it that what we're accepting is the life that's right here. And we tend to translate that life and have an interpretation that it's a self and it's an entity and it's separate and so on. But in actuality, moment by moment, what we're accepting is this feeling, this hurt, this sadness, this fear, this anxiety, this sense of, you know, doing something wrong. We're embracing the lived experience. So it, and what actually happens as we do that is that sense of separate self actually dissolves anyway. The freedom that we experience on the other end of truly accepting the life that's here is we discover that we're way beyond any story we had of ourselves. The flip side, Tammy, is that as long as we're identified as an egoic self, as a separate self, there's always going to be a feeling of deficiency. So we it just comes with the packaging. The ego is built around a sense of deficiency. So all of us are doing this project. It's not just for some of us. Sometimes the deficiency actually expresses as an inflation, a sense of better than. But if we really investigate that, underneath that too is a hollowness, a fear, a separateness. So we're all doing this project of embracing the life that's right here, its pleasantness, its unpleasantness, and the discovering we're beyond any story we might have ever told about ourselves.
So really, though, just to underscore what you're saying, if I heard you correctly, you're saying that whenever there is a sense of separateness, separate ego as who we are, we will feel unworthy. There's something that we're disconnected from or something missing. Is that what
exactly.
I heard you say? Yeah, that's very
exactly.
profound.
Well, if you just consider it, if we're identified as a separate self, we're identified with a fragment of what we are, and there's some wisdom in us that actually recognizes that this isn't the truth of who I am, and this is less than. But unfortunately, we then own that. We get identified, I'm less than, rather than the perception is less than. So if it can be a wake up. It's like, it's actually our portal towards discovering the fullness and the goodness and mystery of who we are.
Wonderful. I've been speaking with Tara Brach. She's published a new book called True Refuge, Finding Peace and Freedom in Your Own Awakened Heart. Makes me want to put my hand on my heart as I say those words, awakened heart. And with Sounds True, Tara has published many different audio programs, including a program called Radical Self-Acceptance, a Buddhist guide to freeing yourself from shame, and an online video course on meditation and psychotherapy, a professional training course for integrating mindfulness into clinical practice. Tara, thank you for being part of the Self-Acceptance series. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, and thank you for offering it, Tammy.
SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey. Thanks for listening.